Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In 2002, fear gripped the nation's capital for weeks. People were scared to get gas, to even go to the store. They were terrified a gunman would randomly take their lives if they did. That killer was Lee Boyd Malvo. He was 17 years old when he and John Allen Muhammad killed 10 people in the D.C. sniper case. Muhammad received the death sentence and was executed in 2009. Malvo was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Now he's 34, and he's asking the Supreme Court to give him the chance to be sentenced again. It is the latest chapter in the court's reassessment of what constitutes justice in juvenile sentencing. So this hour on Point, life sentences in juvenile justice. And you can join us. What do you think adulthood is in the criminal justice system? What age should it be? Should crimes as heinous as murder always come with mandatory life sentences regardless of the person's age? Or do you think juveniles who commit violent crimes should be sentenced differently? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today to talk about this is Marcia Levick. She's with us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She's chief counsel and founder of the Juvenile Law Center, a public interest law firm advocating for children's rights. And as I said, she founded it in 1975, making it one of the oldest continuously operating juvenile law centers in the country. Marcia Levick, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So you have been involved in sort of the nation's reassessment of juvenile sentencing for a long, long time. This is the third time in recent years that the Supreme Court has heard a case on life sentences for juveniles. How significant is this latest hearing?
I think it's significant. You know, what we've seen over the course of actually the last 15 years, if we think back to the first juvenile sentencing case in which the U.S. Supreme Court struck the juvenile death penalty, actually just a couple of years after the D.C. sniper situation in 2005, the court has really upended how we think about juvenile sentencing and has struck the most severe sentencing practices, including the death penalty and mandatory life without parole sentences. This particular case is focused, of course, on Malvo's sentence. Mm-hmm. He did receive a life without parole sentence through the Virginia court system. And the question before the court is both narrow and potentially broad. Narrow in the sense that it's very specifically about what he is entitled to as a consequence of the Supreme Court sentencing decisions. And I think looking forward certainly could have some implications for our sentencing practices in the future.
Okay. So let's talk a little more specifically about this Malvo case here, because as far as I had understood, two of the previous cases that the court had heard in 2012 in Miller v. Alabama and then in 2016, Montgomery versus Louisiana, which you were co-counsel on, that those two cases had actually ended the mandatory life sentence without the possibility of parole for juveniles and also applied it retroactively. So what is Malvo specifically asking that the court hasn't already granted?
So Malvo is asking to be resentenced, of course, under Miller. And the issue specifically in his case is whether or not he received a discretionary life without parole sentence or a mandatory life without parole sentence. The two individuals in the Miller case before the Supreme Court in 2012 both had received mandatory life without parole sentences. But I think one of the most telling moments in the argument yesterday before the U.S. Supreme Court was when Justice Kagan so eloquently reduced the Miller decision, she said, to just two words, and that was that youth matters. And so I think the court is really being asked to address here not so much the breadth of what Miller and Montgomery were about, but really what was the meaning of the decision and whether we're simply focused on mandatory sentencing or if, in fact, we're concerned with ensuring that when we sentence any youth to essentially a sentence to die in prison, that we are appropriately considering the characteristics and attributes of youth.
Okay. In I'll get back to this Youth Matters statement from Justice Kagan in just a moment. But regarding Mr. Malvo, though, again, just to get our facts straight here, in the event that the court decides in his favor, it doesn't mean that he would automatically receive parole, right? He's serving concurrent life sentences. I mean, what would the impact on him specifically be?
Yes, it's a great question and an important question. Malvo is probably never going to be released from prison. He's not only serving life sentences in Virginia, he's also serving sentences for similar homicides that occurred in Maryland and other places. So he's not going to be released. I think it's fair to say that's a remote, very remote possibility. But the principle of establishing that even someone like Malvo, the whole point of these juvenile sentencing cases before the U.S. Supreme Court is that they all dealt with individuals who committed homicide, young people who committed homicide. And the court has really tried to articulate a different paradigm for juvenile sentencing. So even someone like Malvo should be entitled to the consideration about whether or not he might someday be eligible for parole. But in his particular case, no, he's not going to be released.
Okay. Well, let's listen back to what Lee Boyd Malvo himself said. In 2012, the Washington Post interviewed him from jail, and he reflected on the person he was when he committed those really terrible murders in the D.C. sniper case.
I understand what happened. I understand the role I played. I understand what happened to me. And I understand the consequences and the spillover that affected many people's lives. But the question where I'm at is one question. Where do I go from here?
That's Lee Boyd Malvo in 2012 in a Washington Post interview. Now, far more recently, Paul LaRuffa, a surviving victim of Malvo, he once said that he thought that Lee Malvo should get the death penalty. But he just recently told NPR's Nina Totenberg that he supports Malvo getting a second chance now at sentencing.
I'm more interested in not Lee Boyd Malvo as an individual, but in the many, many other people who did things less heinous than him that were sentenced to life without parole when they were 15, 16 years old.
That's Paul LaRuffa, a victim of Lee Boyd Malvo. Marsha Levick, tell me a little bit more about what you hear in the question or the statement of Justice Elena Kagan when she says youth matters. What does that specifically mean in the context of juveniles who've been convicted of murder?
When the Supreme Court struck mandatory sentences, life without parole sentences in Miller in 2012, Justice Kagan wrote that opinion, and she included in her opinion a series of factors, elements or attributes of adolescence and youth that were, in her view, required to, at a minimum, be considered by sentencers going forward, by judges or juries imposing these sentences. And those obviously included issues of age and immaturity, their family background, their capacity to participate in their defense, to understand the criminal justice system, and most importantly, of course, their capacity for change and rehabilitation. And so I think that Justice Kagan was really reminding all of us sitting there in the courtroom that these sentencing cases, they're in part about a very specific sentence that has now been prohibited under our constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. But they're also a requirement. They really impose an obligation on all of us to think differently about youth who commit even the most serious crimes and trying to really fashion a sentencing structure, a sentencing approach that I think, as Paul said, that really is recognizing the opportunity for second chances for this population, again, because of their capacity to change.
But you also heard yesterday Justice Kavanaugh asking a question. Apparently, he was quite active from the bench yesterday in asking his questions when he said that the previous Supreme Court rulings required just judges to distinguish, quote, between someone who's merely immature as opposed to incorrigible. What do you make of that?
Well, first, I want to confirm, sitting there in the courtroom yesterday, he was the most active questioner, I would say. And I think that his questions appear to reflect a very genuine curiosity and interest and struggle to determine exactly what not only Miller and Montgomery represented, but also how he should interpret and apply those cases going forward. And I think that, again, in the way that Justice Kagan was able to reduce Miller to two words, I think he also in many respects summed up what those holdings were about, that they were about imposing on the sentencer this obligation to distinguish between the merely immature and the permanently incorrigible. And if we think about what that means in real terms, it certainly suggests that we have to do more than simply say we can't impose a mandatory sentence on you. It does suggest that there needs to be some recognition, some consideration, some conversation about the youth's immaturity or not, the youth's permanent incorrigibility or not, before we can impose these finite sentences on youth.
Now, this question of permanent incorrigibility, I mean, our understanding of, you know, the teenage brain has changed quite a lot in the past couple of decades here. I mean, is that what's playing a role in this slow reassessment that we've been seeing of juvenile sentencing, even in the most heinous crimes?
Yes, there's no question but that even when the Supreme Court struck the juvenile death penalty in 2005, that the research was front and center in that decision, the current scientific research that in 2005 really highlighted through a social science frame the developmental differences, this maturity versus immaturity, differences between children, adolescents, and adults. Since 2005, of course, that social science research has really been buttressed and bolstered by neuroscience. And we do now all have some appreciation, certainly that the adolescent brain, the child's brain, continues to develop into the early 20s. And I thought that your opening comment posing this question, what is adulthood? How do we define adulthood? Is a question that we are asking ourselves today. And so that even as we are having a conversation now about what is the appropriate sentencing response to Lee Boyd Malvo and the crimes that he committed, there is also a legitimate conversation going on about whether we draw that line at just someone's 18th birthday, whether we draw it at 21 or 24. But as we learn more, science continues to play a very prominent role in how we think about our sentencing practices.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. We're talking with Marcia Levick. She is chief counsel and founder of the Juvenile Law Center, a public interest law firm advocating for children's rights since 1975. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the case of Lee Boyd Malvo. He was one of the D.C. snipers back in 2002. He was 17 at the time when he received multiple life sentences for those murders. His case is now before the United States Supreme Court, where he is asking for a reassessment or a chance at another sentencing hearing, because the core question is, what constitutes justice in these cases of juveniles convicted of murder? Should they ever be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole? I'm joined today by Marcia Levick. She's chief counsel and founder of the Juvenile Law Center, a public interest law firm that's been advocating for children's rights since 1975. And she's been a key legal voice in several of the other cases, or at least one of the other cases that has previously appeared before the court on these matters. So let's go quickly to the phones. Let's go to Sean, who's calling from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hello. I just want to say I work in the correction system. I'm around 17-year-olds on a regular basis. And before I did that, I would have the view that she has, of, or and a lot of people have, that they shouldn't have life sentences. But having been exposed to them on a regular basis, they're young men. They're not children or boys anymore. They're very, very mature. They're very aware of the crimes that they commit, the situations that they put themselves in. And a lot of them, frankly, are almost proud of the things that they do. I absolutely feel that they're old enough. They know what they're doing. They're making the choices that they are, and they're fully willing to accept the consequences that come with it, and they're okay with it, frankly. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't even seem to faze them, you know, when they're looking at 15 or 20 years. Like, yeah, whatever, it's 15 or 20, but, you know, I've done so much here, and I'll do half there plus a day, and I'll be out in like 10 or 8. And it doesn't even bother him at 17.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for your call and your perspective there. And Marcia Levick, I just want to piggyback off Sean's observation here and wind back the clock back to that 2012 Miller v. Alabama case that appeared before the court that upheld that mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole for juveniles was unconstitutional. And Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion in that case. And here's a clip from what he read from the bench in June of 2012.
Think of the worst possible 17-year-old murderer. Perhaps a 17-year-old who previously was convicted of several murders, was tried in family court, and has resisted any attempt at rehabilitation. Or think of a 17-year-old, a 17-and-a-half-year-old, perhaps, who goes to school and guns down a dozen or more teachers and students. The opinion of the court delicately refers to all murderers under the magic age of 18 as children and holds that every single one of these children must be given a chance to persuade a judge to impose a lesser sentence.
Justice Samuel Alito in 2012. Marcia Levick, isn't this, as you said, this is one of the core questions. Like, is there a magic age here? Does there have to be in the justice system?
Well, I think that let me just take a moment to respond, though, to the issues that were raised by the caller and even by Justice Alito's comments, because I think that focusing on how someone behaves at the age of 17, what we observe about them at the age of 17 is actually precisely the point of these cases. And that is that how they appear at 17 is not at all and not necessarily who they will be 25, 35, 45, 55 years old. And it is impossible to ignore the science, whether it's the neuroscience or the social science, that really conclusively establishes this capacity for change. And to the concern that someone has committed a horrible crime at the age of 17, we should never contemplate letting them out. We need to keep in mind that when we talk about providing this opportunity to be eligible for parole, that it is not a ticket out of jail. That at that moment when someone goes before the parole board has to ask itself questions and frankly ask that individual questions that will go to whether or not they have matured, whether or not they have accepted the consequences, whether or not they have demonstrated rehabilitation, whether or not they are able and ready to return to their communities. In many instances, that won't happen. And that's precisely what Justice Kennedy recognized in his 2010 decision prohibiting life without parole in non-homicide cases. We all understand in this space that many of these young men and women won't get out of prison even as they go before a parole board. But we cannot ignore the scientific recognition, the scientific finding about this capacity for change. And as we think about, as I said, sort of, you know, what does this research tell us going forward? It does raise questions that I think we need to be having a conversation about, that it's probably not a magic boundary at 18, that the same aspects of immaturity, the characteristics of immaturity that we see in youth under the age of 18, they often carry forward in many individuals past the age of 18, and certainly brain development continues. And as we contemplate, again, as you said at the opening of this segment, as we contemplate, what does justice mean? What is the purpose of our justice system? We need to be thinking about, again, where research might take us as we try to ensure that we are serving justice.
So let me ask you, Marcia. I mean, what do you think justice means in these cases? Because, I mean, by definition, yes, I mean, neuroscience is showing us that the youth brain not only has the capacity for change, it changes dramatically. But if we're speaking of justice writ large, I mean, isn't the logical conclusion that everyone does have, regardless of age, everyone does have the capacity to change? And if so, I mean, what does that mean for the entire process or act of sentencing in these most terrible crimes?
Well, I think that the capacity for change is different. And so we know that the capacity for change among young people, again, let's say individuals under the age of 25 and most strongly individuals under the age of 18, that's a capacity for change that is especially dynamic, that the kinds of judgments and decisions that they make, think about ourselves as teenagers, if my daughters who were teenagers not so long ago, the kinds of judgments that young people make appear in the moment. They will say sometimes, I know exactly what I was doing. So it can appear as if there is some thoughtfulness behind the decisions that they make, but we know that there isn't. And so I think that this, while yes, it's true, everyone can change, and I think we want to believe that everyone can change as we grow older ourselves, as we examine ourselves. We maybe want to change aspects of ourselves even so. But I think that we're talking a little bit about apples and oranges. And when we think about the possibility for rehabilitation and real transformation of character, that is something that really is unique to a particular segment of the population. And it's the young population in this country.
Well, let's go to Christine, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was actually a freshman at George Washington University when the D.C. sniper case happened, and to this day, I'm still afraid of white conversion vans. So I think I'm so glad that you're talking about this topic because being from New York, we just had the Raise the Age bill pass. And I think a really important distinction is the difference between violent and nonviolent crimes. Mm-hmm. And how, and I think it's a really slippery slope when you start opening the idea of changing, mandatory life sentences for violent crimes, because then it kind of opens the door for everything. And, it's not like some kid that was in jail for like a drug offense or a robbery or something like that was not violent. Like, this was a calculated murder of multiple people, and he terrorized the city. And I think you can't, like your guest was just saying, apples to oranges. You can't compare these type of calculated violent crimes to like a nonviolent crime.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for your call. Marcia Levick, would you like to respond to Christine?
Sure. And let me say, first of all, I have certainly many friends who were in D.C. in 2002 and who are still there. And I understand and I completely appreciate the fear, not only that you and your friends and family members felt then, but of course what people continue to recall and remember about that time. But I think that the Supreme Court, when it really ruled in Miller striking mandatory life without parole sentences, what Justice Kagan said was that there was no reason to treat the science differently, those scientific findings differently, with respect to individuals who commit violent crimes or nonviolent crimes. And while I think that we live in a culture that is highly retributive, we think about, again, this question, what is justice? Many of us in this country think about justice as really being about punishment and revenge. And when something horrible happens, we want to do something horrible in return. But I think that as we evolve and as we think about what our values should be, certainly from my perspective, I think that our values need to include for certain populations not only a consideration for retribution, but also, again, this opportunity for rehabilitation, this opportunity for second chances. Mm-hmm. And to recall, again, I think that it's wrong to conflate the idea of eliminating life without parole sentences that prohibit someone from ever getting out of prison from giving them an opportunity to be considered for release. Because as I said, many of those individuals won't get relief. Many of those individuals who committed perhaps the most brutal, the most heinous violent crimes may never be candidates for release. But we cannot know that when they're 17 or 16 or 15. And to meet this goal of justice in our society, we need to be willing to reexamine those individuals at a later point in time.
The thing about cases like Malvo's is that it brings these core questions about what is justice regarding juvenile offenders into very sharp relief, right? Because it's an extreme case, a terrible,
exactly,
extreme case where for 2 weeks he and Muhammad went around murdering people from, you know, as snipers. So yes, in his case, he was given a multiple life sentences without the possibility of parole. But the bigger picture also is that other youth offenders get similar sentences for very different kinds of crimes, right? So let me turn now to Marshawn Allen, who joins us from Chicago, Illinois, because when he was 15 years old, he was sentenced to life without parole. He was involved in a drug deal and robbery that ended in a man being killed. Marshawn Allen didn't pull the trigger, but he was charged with two counts of first-degree murder. Ended up being released in 2016 after serving 25 years because of one of the Supreme Court's decisions, the Miller v. Alabama decision. So Marshawn Allen, welcome to you. Marshawn, can you hear me? Well, let's see if we can get Marshawn Allen back on the phone here. But Marsha Levick, talk to me a little bit about, I read the facts of Marshawn's case here. I mean, that's part of the big picture that we have to look at, that he's someone who didn't even pull the trigger but ended up with a life sentence without the possibility of parole at the age of 15.
That's precisely right. And I think that your comments really underscore this principle that the exception can't make the rule. And it is hard to have a conversation about a more generous or I think lenient view of sentencing of adolescents, teenagers who commit even homicide crimes and talk about it in the context of Lee Boyd Malvo, which is a horrific incident that we hope will never be repeated. I think in Marshawn's case, there are many individuals across the country just like him who did not pull the trigger, who might have been present at the time when a crime was committed and in the course of that crime and the victim died at somebody else's hands. They were sentenced identically to the individual who was directly responsible for that murder. And that is an enormous travesty of justice that goes on every day. In my state of Pennsylvania, we have many individuals who were sentenced to life without parole, mandatory sentences of life without parole, under the exact same circumstances. And his case highlights how we cannot think about these cases, we cannot examine them through one lens. Everybody is different, and that's precisely the point of the court's decisions.
Mm. Well, let's see if we have Marshawn Allen back on the line here. Marshawn, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us today in this discussion here. Can you just tell us a little bit about when you were 15 and you began serving your life sentence without the possibility of parole? I mean, take us back to that moment in time. What were you like? What kind of person were you then at 15?
Well, at the age of 15, I have to step back and explain that I had an older brother who I looked up to, who was involved in drug dealer. And my dad was using drugs and he wasn't around. And my mom's brothers, who actually introduced my brother to selling drugs, they were actually the only male role models that I had around. So those were the people I was looking up to. So growing up in an environment, not just in my community, but also in my family household where selling drugs and was acceptable, you know, it had a very impressionable role in my life. But I was a youth. I was in high school. I was very into, like, fixing things with my hands and working on cars and things like that. I wasn't a bad kid. Of course, I got into trouble like every kid mm-hmm. does when they're, especially boys, get into trouble when they're their age. But I was not, at that point, I had never been charged or convicted or committed any acts of violence when my case happened. And the circumstances of it happening was, you know, as you know, it was a drug mm-hmm. deal that went bad. Individuals had came to buy a large amount of drugs from my brother and ended up putting a gun up to my head and forcing me to take them up to the apartment where my brother was had his drugs and money, where he's running his business from. And they made us lay on the ground, and after they made the drug deal, they actually kidnapped me and made me take them back to the location where I had picked them up. And so
That's the situation that led to it. My role in the crime was just still in the vehicle that was used.
Mm-hmm.
And that came about with me being a teenager. I was really into cars. I love cars. I love driving them, fixing on them and everything. So I learned at a very young age how to drive.
Yeah.
And actually was learn how to steal cars from, like, other individuals in my neighborhood.
Right. Marshawn, if I can just interrupt here. We've just got a minute before I have to let you go here. You were released in 2016. You served 25 years, right? And now you you manage an advocacy group called the Restore Justice Foundation. I mean, in just the minute we have before I have to let you go here, what do you think, you know, your experience, what lessons should we draw from your experience about how we ought to be looking at questions of juvenile sentencing?
Well, as Marcia said, and as the science says, that youth are different, that we do change, that we shouldn't have this sentence that's being imposed on every youth. That it should be an individual consideration that should be made before these sentences are made. And there shouldn't be, as we always say, that there is no crystal ball for the judge to know at the time of sentencing how an individual is going to turn out. So there should be some mechanism in play, in place where a youth can be reviewed 10 years into a sentence to decide where he's at, whether or not he's been rehabilitated, can be safely released into society. We shouldn't just be categorically sentencing youth without parole, without giving them a chance to redeem themselves.
Well, Marshawn Allen, he manages the advocacy and outreach for the Restore Justice Foundation and is a board member of the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth, joining us from Chicago. Marshawn, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Marcia Levick, stand by here for just a moment. We have to take a quick break. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Marcia Levick. She is chief counsel and founder of the Juvenile Law Center, a public interest law firm that's been advocating for children's rights since 1975. And we're talking with Marcia because this week the Supreme Court heard another case that is asking the court to reassess sentencing for juveniles who've committed murder. And Marcia, let me ask you, I mean, you have been deeply involved in this work since 1975. It seems as if in the past, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, we've been seeing a kind of rapid pace of change in how the courts are looking at juvenile cases like this, even the most extreme ones. Because, I mean, wasn't it just in the 90s where one of the prevailing theories about juvenile offenders was that of incorrigible super predators?
Yes. and I'm glad that you asked that question. When I think about the trajectory of my work and the work of my colleagues in this field, the cases in the recent cases decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in the last 15 years, I think, are very much a response to what happened as a consequence of what we now was the super predator myth of the 1990s, this notion that we were coming upon a generation of violent teenagers who would terrorize our neighborhoods. That proved to be false, but before it was recanted by the scientists who came up with it, we saw hundreds of thousands of children being tried as adults in the criminal justice system. The numbers at some points during the 1990s were as high as 200,000 children a year were being charged as adults. And what that meant was that as they passed through that system, if they were convicted, they were subject to the full brunt of adult sentencing. That included, of course, the death penalty in some states, and it included life without parole or very, very long term of year sentences. And so when the Supreme Court was finally, when they made the decision to reexamine the constitutionality of the death penalty in 2005, I think it was very much in part in response to the concern that we had so many youth in this country being convicted and sentenced as adults, and also the coincidental emergence of science that had come out, really beginning a research network convened by the MacArthur Foundation in the mid-1990s. That research began to make its way into both the academic conversations as well as, I think, the public discourse. And of course, as I said, was very foundational in the Supreme Court's decision. And so as you kind of had this moment where you had hundreds of thousands of youth in the criminal justice system and very compelling research that they were different, that they were less blameworthy. And those I think those things coming together really did lead to, I think, what is fair to say, a revolution in sentencing of juveniles in this country.
I guess there's something I want to come back to with you, Marcia, because I'm wondering, how should we be looking at the issue of culpability, the question of culpability? And here's why I ask, because, I mean, you said earlier that there is a deep streak in the American criminal justice system that is punitive, right? And so I wonder, I mean, that's for a reason. And bear with me here as I walk through this thought experiment, okay? Because, you know, for example, in cases of sexual assault in college, now we're not talking about minors here, we're talking about college students, but I've heard frequently people say, well, look, lots of college students get drunk, but even in their inebriated states, most of them don't sexually assault people. Is that, I mean, that's an interesting analogy to me, because should the same question be asked of youth offenders, that most 17-year-olds, most 16-year-olds, most 15-year-olds, even with their developing brains, they don't commit these terrible crimes? So shouldn't punishment – there's a reason why punishment is part of the criminal justice system, even for juveniles.
Yes, and I don't think that we can ignore the role that punishment plays. The role of holding people accountable for what they do is certainly a core element, I think, of any justice system. But I think that the fact that not everyone does it is not a reason to throw out those or throw away those who do. Because this issue of culpability is also relevant to our concern, I think a constitutional concern, for proportionality, ensuring that when we do in fact punish people and hold them accountable, we do it in ways that are proportionate to their culpability for the crimes that they commit. So I think we have to focus on those who do get caught up in the justice system, not those who don't. And what we know about these individuals is that, again, as youth, as adolescents, their ability to make mature decisions, to make good decisions, is poor. They are impulsive. They're impetuous. And it would be wrong, I think, as a matter of constitutional law. I really think that's what the U.S. Supreme Court has said in a series of the last three decisions on sentencing, that we simply cannot, as a matter of constitutional law, treat them the same as we would adults, because their levels of culpability are less and their levels of maturity and judgment are less. And it is very much about, as I said, this concern for proportionality. And this comes directly out of how we think about our Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, let's go to Gary, who's calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Gary, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm retired law enforcement out of the city of Montgomery, and I actually responded to one of the D.C. sniper scenes when they passed through Montgomery. And I've also taken into custody juveniles at the age of 15 that had 15 priors. So I understand what you're talking about. But let me say, we're not born human beings. We learn how to be a human being. And when a child is raised in an atmosphere that's inhumane, then that's what they know. And at such a young age, they don't have the opportunity to control their impulse behavior. So if you sentence them to life in prison in a hostile environment, they will never really learn how to be a decent human being.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for that call. Marsha, I'll let you respond to that in a second, but I want to get one more call here. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from New Orleans. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When I was 11 years old, was coming back from an exhibition baseball game in the Superdome in New Orleans, and a 16 and 17-year-old tried to rob my family, and I watched my father get murdered. The person who is still in jail for the crime has the possibility of coming up for parole now because of the change in the sentencing guidelines. And while objectively it's nice to talk about this, what Gary said I think is absolutely correct. This person came from a background without parental responsibility, which I think is something that needs to be addressed when this is addressed. And now you're going to... This person's been in Angola for almost 40 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And how's that person going to function in society? How are we going to, do we want to take that chance? I mean, we received death threats called to my house after the crime saying that if we testified, they would come after us.
Huh. Steve, I'm so sorry to have to interrupt you there. It's just I'm running out of time, but thank you so much for your call and for sharing what happened to you and your family. Marsha Levick, how would you respond to both Gary and Steve?
Well, I think they both present very real and important perspectives on what we're talking about. And I think to Gary's point, I appreciate his understanding from the position where he is that precisely the kinds of issues that he raised, the family background, how someone really grows up, the environment that they grow up in, is something that should be considered and is something that can be changed if we can change that environment over the course of their lives. And of course, to Steve's story, horribly tragic, and you know, can't really even appreciate the grief that he and his family experienced. But I can say to Steve that since Miller and Montgomery came down, we have had hundreds of men and women released across the country. Again, in my state of Pennsylvania, where we had 500 men and women serving life without parole sentences, we've had about 225 released. Like Marshawn, they're individuals who have come back to their communities, who are giving back, who are many of them working in advocacy or social justice or community organizations. And I think one of the things that has been most stunning to me in my work is to appreciate, as challenged as these individuals were, as hardened perhaps as they were when they went into prison, with very few opportunities for programs in these prison settings, self-educated, grew up, literally grew up in prison, became mature, redeemed themselves, accepted the consequences of their actions, and are different people. And so to the concern, can we manage them coming back into our communities? I say yes, because I think we're seeing it play out in real time every day right now across the country.
Well, Marsha Levick is chief counsel and founder of the Juvenile Law Center, a public interest law firm that she founded in 1975. Marsha, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, in a moment, we'll turn and remember the life of Congressman Elijah Cummings. This is On Point. Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings died early this morning in Baltimore. He was 68. Cummings was the son of South Carolina sharecroppers who got his start in office as Howard University's student government president. And in recent years, he was among the most powerful Democrats in Congress. As chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, Cummings was a forceful voice in the House investigations into President Donald Trump. Take this moment from February, where Cummings offered these closing remarks following testimony from Michael Cohen, then Trump's former personal lawyer.
We're better than that. We really are. And I'm hoping that all of us can get back to this democracy that we want and that we should be passing on our children so that they can do better than what we did.
Congressman Elijah Cummings there in February in the House in Washington. But he was nowhere loved more than in his home city of Baltimore. And joining us now from Baltimore, Maryland, is City Council President Brandon Scott. Mr. Scott, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very sorry that it's under these circumstances. What does the passing of Congressman Cummings mean to you and to Baltimore?
Well, it's heartbreaking for Baltimore, for me, and for this country. With Congressman Cummins, we are losing a true American hero and someone whose legacy will be unmatched by elected officials that follow him, and we can only hope to live up to that legacy. But we have lost a true American hero and a true Baltimorean. I've lost a mentor and a friend today, and the world mourns for him.
Can you tell us how he mentored you? What kind of mentor was he to you?
Listen, Congressman Cummins, if you're an elected official in Baltimore City, we all, from the mayor on down, get summons to his office for tutelage. And it's not just about how to be. For me, it wasn't just about how to be a better city council person and now the city council president, a better legislator, but more so it's about how to be a better man and a better person. And he always said, Brandon, the reason why you caught my eye is because you always, even when you're disagreeing with someone, you do that with dignity and respect. And he told me you have to continue that even when you're being attacked. And then I saw that happen firsthand with him and the president this year, and I knew then really why he did that, because the world needed him to have dignity and respect and to not fight back. And that's why we have to live our lives and lead in the way that he lead, in such a humble way of being someone who can go and talk to dignitaries across the world, but that you would see on the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and North Avenue in Baltimore talking to homeless people and have his voice be just as respected by both. That is the kind of person that he was. You growing up here in Baltimore City, you knew that he was going to be in your school. You knew that he was going to be delivering one of his powerful speeches that would inspire you, and he would spend time talking to you. So we're truly heartbroken today.
Mm. Well, I want to play a moment where Congressman Cummins recalled a story about something he witnessed when he was sworn in as a member of the House of Representatives. Because last January, he talked with 60 Minutes Steve Croft about the day in 1996 when he was sworn into the House. And he told Croft that as he stood there with his hand held up, being sworn in, he caught a glimpse of his father in the gallery wiping away tears. And Congressman Cummins had said that he'd never seen his father cry before. And afterwards, he asked his father if he was crying out of pride for his son. And here's the rest of the story from Congressman Cummins.
And he said, isn't this the place? And my father had never been in the Capitol building. He said, isn't this the place where they used to call us slaves? I said, yes, sir. And isn't this the place they used to call us three-fifths of a man? I said, yes, sir. And isn't this the place that they used to call us chattel? I said, yes, 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 sir. He said, you know, and he said these words, Steve, and I'll never forget. He said, when I think about you being sworn in today, he said, now I see what I could have been.
That's Congressman Elijah Cummings speaking to Steve Croft on 60 Minutes in January. Mr. Scott, when you hear that, what does that make you think about the congressman?
It brings tears to my eyes, and I remember, and he's actually told that story here in Baltimore many times, and it makes me think about why I have to be a better person, why I have to be a better elected official, why I have to work every day to stand on his broad world bearing weight shoulders to try to take our city, our state, and our country to higher heights, because I know all that he went through. He blazed a path. He made a road and put asphalt on it so that a young man and young women from Baltimore who come from neighborhoods like he came from could be elected. I would not be a city council president in Baltimore if there were not Elijah Cummins. Listen, I've been saying all day that before, here in Baltimore, before there was Barack Obama, there was Elijah Cummins. That is how high regard we hold him in, because he is a champion for us each and every day. That's what he lived his life to, make our city a better place. And knowing where he came from and how he wants us to now take what he done, take that work and take it to the next level, knowing that my family comes from a similar background, it just brings tears to the eyes, because today we have really lost a hero. We've really lost a fighter who worked until the end to try to save our city and save our country and save our democracy.
Well, Brandon Scott is the city council president for the city of Baltimore. He was mentored by Congressman Elijah Cummings, speaking to us today from Baltimore to help us remember the congressman who died this morning at the age of 68. Brandon Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Line, David Marino, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.